This week on Out of the Air features the premier Groucho Marx impersonator, Frank Ferrante, discussing his long association with his one-man show and other performing pursuits. Next, acrylic artist Zoo Stevenson, whose paintings reflect the inner world of women and flowers. Our spotlights on Family Folklore's Foundation's Meg DeMarcus, her new book, Millennia of Progress, the Chicago World's Fair, If Houses Could Talk.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight. She's been with us many times before talking about all the wonderful things that the Family Folklore Foundation is doing. And this one's going to be a new book, but it's also connected to some performances. Meg DeMarcus is coming back here. Again, it's about the World's Fair Homes. And she's penned a new book about that. And so she's going to try it. Meg, thank you for coming back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you for inviting me.
Hi, Meg.
Hi.
Hey, Meg. So what was that initial spark that got you interested in the Century of Progress Homes? Was there a particular moment that you went, wow, I really want to know more about this?
Well, actually, it was my late great brother, Dan Granfield, who put together an article for the Indiana Historical Society about how did those houses go from the fair to Beverly Shores. He was a landscape architect and worked at Chester. And it was just something that always bugged him. And he wrote something that is very nice, but it's so technical that it's hard for people to understand. So I wanted to break it down for everybody.
Wonderful.
How we did our project.
And in the past, you tell us a little bit. I know we talked about this in our previous shows. You actually did a performance at IUN. And tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, the mission of Family Folklore is to offer experiential experience learning activities to people of all ages. And that year, we selected the 1933 World's Fair for mainly the houses that came to Beverly Shores. But then we started learning about the actual fair, and it was so amazing that we kind of broke it down to the different exhibits and different people. I wanted them to write this time. You know, that's what my forte is. And so we had about 25 people online, and they wrote about different exhibits. They also recorded their voices, and we gave this presentation at Main Stage Theater at IUN, which seats 500, and they let us put a PowerPoint on the back wall, which was just wonderful, of the fair and the houses. And then we had people in the group that dressed like the tugboat that came, that brought the barge over. And yeah, and we had a gal, Rebecca Swerden, dressed up as Barbie to do the Florida house. And we used nylon kids tents. We got the idea from the Barbie doll dream house, which is what they called the Florida house. And so they were selling it in Hammaker and Schlimmer. And I'm like, that's it. Because we were trying to build the houses for the stage, and it was like impossible. So we just bought the tents. And then we also had a puppet show, because the houses are in the Indiana Dunes National Park. And so we have all these darling woodland puppets that were, and it was right near Earth Day. And they were talking to the audience about global warming and don't throw your trash away, you know, that kind of thing.
Very good. So was the book always part of this whole project or did one evolve into the other?
It was mainly going to be a project, but when we started getting books about the World's Fair, they kept showing us guidebooks, you know, and books that, you know, and so that's what this, I call this a companion book or a guidebook for our project and what we learned. So I kind of used that idea. And then I always wanted to have a coffee table book, you know, like on Seinfeld. This one does not have legs, but... But so I have it in paperback on Amazon, but I also have hardback, which is on sale at a variety of gift shops around here. The Press in Valpo, the Munster Performing Arts Center gift shop, Beverly Shores. That's just a few to mention. I probably have some more if I think hard. And so I'm getting the word out, and I feel like my brother Dan is glad because he wanted the world to get the word to get out. What was the coolest thing was four houses that weighed too much for a truck. They came over one at a time on a barge pushed by a tugboat. And they were either put up on the dune or they were unassembled and put up on the dune and reassembled. And two of them weighed more than the space shuttle. And so, you know, it was just interesting. And, you know, the fair was very large, 430 acres. It was from the planetarium all the way down to the Science and Industry Museum along the shore.
Right.
And then they built an island, northerly island, out of the ashes of the 1871 Chicago Fair. And so it was called the Century of Progress because Chicago had been incorporated into a city 100 years before that.
Right.
And so I actually have IU students that are writing, even right now, that's their assignment. They are writing about how things have changed in our 100 years.
Okay.
So that's why I call it Millennia of Progress.
So, Meg, with all your knowledge about the homes, which house would you be happy living in?
Well, we pretended like we were the houses.
Right.
My monologue was the House of Tomorrow. And, you know, it had 12 sides. It was all windows. It had a... port for airplanes, you know, it had everything. It was the first air conditioned, central heat, and electrified building. And, I thought that was pretty cool.
In our last few moments, where can they find the book? You had the book launch, I think on Baston, November 2nd, but where can they find the book real quickly in our last few moments here, Meg?
In Valpo at the Press, at Beverly Shores and their gift shop. And at the Munster Performing Arts Center in their gift shop.
Very good. That was Meg Demakis from Family Folklore Foundation and her new book, Millennia Progress, 1933 to 2023, the Chicago World's Fair, If Houses Could Talk. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight and sharing your new book.
Yes, yeah, nice seeing you, Meg.
And a Spotlight Extra. Chesterton's 4th Street Theater presents Grant Fitch in his one-man version of Charles Dickens' classic, A Christmas Carol, on November 30th. And December 7th at 7 p.m. and December 1st at 3 p.m. Tickets are available online at 4thStreetTheaterCCA.com or by calling 219-926-7875. Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker.
This is Peter Marks, former theater critic of the Washington Post, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Frank Ferrante to Art on the Air. Frank is an actor, comedian, writer, and director known for his improvisation and audience interactive comedy. For almost 40 years, he has embodied the character and essence of Groucho Marx, accumulated an abundant amount of accolades and awards, so many that to name them would entail most of our program today. He also created Caesar's Circus, a raucous vaudeville burlesque cabaret show. One experience that made me smile was being drawn by Al Hirschfield, the legendary illustrator and the caricature appearing in the New York Times. That's really wow, Frank. A quote about his performance as Groucho, a side-splitting one show that lets audiences re-experience the spirit, delightful mirth, and the wild merriment of the funny man we called the one, the only Groucho. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Frank. It's really wonderful meeting you.
Oh, it's a treat to be here with both of you. Thank you so much, and thank you for that introduction.
Well, we appreciate you coming on, and we had adjusting the schedule to make it work for us. And, of course, I add that Frank was recently at the Center for Visual Performing Arts, performing there, and he was doing there for, I think, two afternoons with our friend Phil Potemka, who now runs the theater, my old stomping grounds back in the 90s. So, but, you know, what we want to know is about your origin story, Frank. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Frank.
Well, I grew up in Southern California. I was born in downtown Los Angeles, and I grew up in a fairly quiet, quaint town called Sierra Madre, near Pasadena. And I was basically a fairly self-conscious, shy kid, like most kids. And early on, I was exposed to comedy, in particular the comedy of the Marx Brothers. A friend, a neighborhood friend, and he said, "Frank, put on the TV set, and you got to see these guys." I didn't know what he was talking about, but I did. Back when you called it a TV set, of course. And this would have been in the early 70s. I was about 9 years old, and it turned out to be the Marx Brothers in A Day at the Races. And I'm watching these flickering black and white images, and there's this crazy man with a big black mustache and a cigar and bobbing eyebrows and a funny walk, and he's talking to me directly. He's doing these asides, as they're called, and he's with his brother. I figure out later, the guy Checo, and they're doing the Tootsie Frutsy ice cream scene, and I'm laughing out loud. Get a Tootsie Frutsy ice cream. Groucho's going, I'm getting a pretty good Tootsie Frutsy myself. Checo is conning Groucho in a classic Marx Brothers film, and it tickled me, and I liked what I was seeing, and I kept watching the film, and I saw how wild and free they were, and I wanted to be like these people, these creatures. And so I went, that night I went to bed, and I reenacted that routine with my brother Tony, who lives in a suburb of Chicago, with his family. And we reenacted this routine, and I became hooked. And this was, in the early 70s, mid-70s, when Groucho Marx was an octogenarian and going through a major revival, a renaissance. You couldn't not see Groucho Marx somewhere, whether it was on television or at a art house, a film, a cinema in town, or a talk show, or live even doing appearances. So the three ages of Groucho Marx were right before us. His films when he was in his 40s. You Bet Your Life was in reruns on TV when he was a middle-aged man, and he was still alive, tooling around and doing appearances. He was huge. And so I went into my local library and started researching the Marx Brothers humor, Groucho Marx specifically, read a book called Son of Groucho, which was in my local library in Sierra Madre, and that expanded. I became obsessed and, went through all the periodical guides and looked up every reference you could find in magazines back when people used periodical guides. And that broadened into an interest in performance in general and comedy in general. So really Groucho's artistry and his genius is what led me to want to participate in the world of theater. And so I was reading about playwrights, and I was reading about directors and the New York scene and Broadway and vaudeville and the world of music. And I was fascinated. So that was my entree. And when you grow up in a small town, it was a thing for me. It gave me a hobby. It gave me something to do. And I loved the brashness and boldness of the humor that emboldened me. And a lot of my peers, a lot of us, I'm about to go see a friend of mine for lunch who also, so many of us were inspired by the humor of the Marx Brothers, which is rule breaking. And I was taught by nuns and in a Catholic school. Then I went to an all boys Catholic high school. So you get the appeal. Groucho was so inappropriate, so brash, so rude, so on the money, so clever. And I love the combination of wordplay, the puns, the turn of a phrase, juxtaposed with his physical humor. He was so physical, agile, and balletic, and he was a good dancer. And his voice could go from falsetto, goes from falsetto to bass. And I thought, wow, this guy's got it all. So that was the beginning. So I started doing plays in school, in grammar school, and then high school is where I really, at LaSalle High School in Pasadena, is where I really started to find my way as a performing artist. And I did musicals. The first play I did, though, was The Front Page, where I played the mayor of Chicago. And that, but fittingly enough, having spent so much time working in Chicago over the last 5 years, and that was a rat-a-tat-tat comedy by Hecton MacArthur. And then the first musical I did, in which I had a lead, was Anything Goes, Cole Porter's Anything Goes. And I realized how much my life has been lifted because of Cole Porter and that music, the romance of it, the humor of it. And when I'm down or need lifting, I'll go to Cole Porter to this day. And, you know, I was in the show when I was 15. That's, I don't know how many years ago that is. You know, I'm 61 now. So that's it. And I realized, and I got big laughs in that show. And I didn't know what that was. And it was exhilarating. And I just kept going. And I did The Music Man and Guys and Dolls. And I did 1776, playing all the leads in those pieces. And then I went to, and I figured, wow, I think I might have something here. I certainly love it. And I'm exhilarated by it. And just as I was exhilarated by the humor of the Marx Brothers because of the freshness. There's something quite eternal and fresh about the humor of the Marx Brothers, that writing, those personas, those personae, I should say. And so that was it. So I went to USC to study theater. And this is in the early 80s. And I didn't know what I wanted. I couldn't admit that I wanted to be an actor. It was embarrassing to me because I didn't come from it. My grandparents were all immigrants from Italy. Three of the four of them were immigrants. You know, you were expected to kind of do what everyone else did, go into business, do something so, you know, legitimate. And no one else was in the arts. It was, you know, a bit of a freakish thing to consider. It just wasn't something you would do. But I was called to it. I wanted it, and I felt a certain passion about it. So the first 2 years at SC, I was a bit lost. And then finally I decided, you know what? What the hell? I'm going to just
embrace it.
I'm going to embrace it. I'm just rambling here. I'm just, you said, tell me your origin story. It's going to jump in.
Well, you know, I do want to, you know, you did mention something that I would like to ask you about. So with as you were reenacting or doing the skits with your family, whose role did you portray during those? Or was it fluid? I mean,
I played Groucho, and my brother, okay. My brother was Chico. So I tormented my poor brother with these. They grew up having to hear all these comedy albums and recordings and musicals. But yeah, so my brother, and to this day, he's a great supporter of mine. He's as proud of me as I am of him. He's had such a beautiful.
It's so interesting because the Marx Brothers were so much about the delivery and the interplay. And so I'm sure studying that was such a great, I mean, that was like being mentored, what you chose to do.
It's a great point because I feel like I was getting master classes from the time I was a boy. So I was listening to Groucho Marx's Rhythm on LPs, on television.
You bet your life. I mean, he was just brilliant.
One morning. Oh. I give one morning I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know. You know, that kind of bum, 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 bum. That, you know, again, that rat-a-tat-tat delivery. But I also was watching Jack Benny when I was a kid. Yeah. Opposite tact, who was the, Groucho was the aggressor in his comedy. And Benny being the react, you know, the one who reacted, the reactor. Different styles, the use of...
Oh, gosh, Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin. I mean, like so much physical, beautiful movement.
W.C. Fields was another one who, you know, who I was just looking, wow, well, how is this working? He's like one of the most successful entities of all time. But just the fact that he had this persona that was kind of anti-everything. And that, but yet the public embraced feels. They embraced Groucho, and maybe it's this anti-establishment core that they come from an anti-establishment point of view. It's during the Depression era, and there's a lot to be upset about and revolt against. And they represented a lot of the madness and chaos and attack.
But they did it as a character. I mean, Groucho had the grease paint, and Harpo had the wig, and, you know, so it softened.
Absolutely.
You know.
Well, they're clowns. They're masked. Right. You know, when I other this character, Caesar character in shows that I've done, like Teatro Zanzani and Cabaret Zazu, and it's a mask. I'm wearing full-on rouge and lipstick and a big black mole. And when you have this mask on, like Groucho did, you can do anything.
You can be anyone, yeah.
And you can get away with doing things you can't even imagine doing and saying things that you would never even consider. And my Caesar character, inspired and by Groucho's improv work, is like that. And Groucho certainly, that's why the Groucho glasses still exist. It's a way to put up a filter. A little bit of a bridge between you and the world, and you're keeping people at arm's length when you have a mask on. But with
Groucho, you're also welcoming them in because he has such a beloved, persona as well. So right. It's a mask, but also it's an invitation.
Right. Well, it's a great point, Esther, in that it is that we live vicariously through their antics and their behavior, which is, breathtaking and so wrong.
Yeah, yet, completely.
I was exhilarated by their antisocial behavior because of, we're being hit by nuns. We're being told what to do. We're as children, we're just there to follow the rules.
And right.
They say yes, we say yes. They said no, they said no. There's an adolescent quality to them. There's a freedom. The older I get, the more I realize it was their freedom that appeals to me. Groucho, the Marx was freedom. And most great comedians, they're free. Stand-ups today. You look at the hottest stand-ups today, they say what they, I mean, I still have my breath taken away by certain comedians. And you wonder, and you go, wow, should he have said that? And I've seen everything. I've seen most stand-up comedians and most forms of comedy. And I figure that's the way people used to feel about the Marx Brothers and Field.
Yeah, it feels so good to deeply laugh.
It's so true. And it's rare to deeply laugh. And when you do, like I find myself going down the rabbit hole on Facebook and just get little clips of comedian stand-ups from Sarah Silverman and, to Bill Burr to, you name it, to Tom Segura. And I love that. And I also want to know what are people laughing at today and what buttons are being pushed today and what subject matter is being discussed and put out there for the public. You're right. But to belly laugh is there's nothing better than that. And I've been fortunate because I've been in front of audiences for a long time. And I always feel like my job is to make people to laugh hard, at least within the persona of Groucho and in the Caesar character that I concocted. I've been lucky to have a couple of these. And then I've done other, I direct plays as well. And I've been in other musicals and plays. But those are two characters that have really helped carry me through the years and come out of the pandemic. We were the first, I was the first actor to address an audience in Chicago on stage, coming out of the pandemic. I was very proud of that.
As Caesar, or was it as Groucho?
It was as Caesar. It was part of this, which is basically a variety show, high-end variety burlesque vaudeville cabaret show. And that was thrilling because we all needed it. And it was like this huge, sigh from the audience.
Bellows.
We all remember what it was like. And we're still recovering from it. We're still trying to come back from that.
Well, Frank, one thing I wanted you brought up a little bit is, have you had to adjust in our socially conscious and, sensitive side of any of the Groucho humor, or does it play well just fine because the way it is and they kind of, because it was so irreverent at the time, people give it a pass, like, okay, this is kind of a historical thing, or have you had to adjust the show at all in modern times?
It's a great question, and I'm very sensitive to how it comes off in 2024. Yes. I mean, I don't, there's so much to Groucho's persona that you don't, you know, certainly he was, you know, he was had that quality of the eyebrows, you know, and there was, you know, Harpo chasing a girl. And I just, there's so much else to emphasize. So I de-emphasize the leering and go with the absurdity and the physicality. And a lot of my show, An Evening with Groucho, which I do constantly and have for almost 40 years since I was in school at USC, which is where we left off, I really lean into the crowd work and have become quite proficient at working a crowd as Groucho. And that's about a third of the show. And so, and that's really me. That's my work, you know, within his persona. And I sing his songs, I story tell. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly of a time. And you have to put it within the context. It's still, fortunately, it still works. I just did, a couple weeks ago, within a few days, I was in New Jersey, I was in Munster, Indiana, and I was in Los Angeles. And the audiences loved it in all three spots. But it's a great question. And I work with the director, Drea Weber, this very strong female, and she has an eye out for how it's being perceived and what, you know, what joke may not, you know, can you still say one more, you know, I can, to Margaret, you know, Margaret Dumont is his, you know, famous foil who embodies the establishment, the elite, you know, the rich, you know, the spoiled. And she's a clown character. She really, you know, she represents the 1%. And Groucho is the outsider. He's the little Jewish immigrant on high society. And that's the dynamic, really. So can I still say, I can see you right now in the kitchen bending over a hot stove, but I can't see the stove. Now, that's a famous joke. Now, it may have gotten a bigger laugh even 10 years ago, but people will think twice maybe today because they'll maybe consider it body shaming, right, not knowing that she is 6'2" and he's 5'7", but she is a massive, person. She's, compared to him, she is the Statue of Liberty. So, you know,
it's interesting. I read a story and I don't know whether it's true or not, but he said that she was yes, she was acting, but she was totally clueless as to his humor.
Well, yeah, it's funny. That's an ongoing debate amongst us real Grouchophiles online on social media and, you know, on Facebook and so forth. Groucho would say she never understood the jokes. She said to him, Julius, what are they laughing at? But she, there's no way. She was in show business from the time she was a teenager. She was in burlesque. She knew exactly what she was doing, how to set up the jokes, how to set him up. Her job
is to be his foil.
Is to great man. But now they did do things, I'm sure, behind her back, and she had no idea what they were doing. Because imagine four wild young men wreaking havoc around you. And so I think there were times she didn't know why they were laughing, because so much was going on about her.
So, Frank, I have like a three-part question. One is, like, do you have rituals as you go into a show? Another part would be, you know, it's a very physical show. Do you have you have to stay limber? And a lot of us are born limber, but do you have a routine that you maintain? And now here's the hard part of the question is, what is your thoughts on aging in the role? And do you have someone who, what is your sort of long-term plan for?
Well, the first part, I warm up vocally. And I realize I warm up even when I'm not doing shows. I'm in the shower. I'm constantly warming up. I'm going to knock wood. I've never lost my voice. I've never missed a show in 40 years, 3,000 plus performances, 500 cities. And I've never been late. So I pride myself on that. I mean, that's the basic. I do warm up. I am 61 and I stretch like crazy because I still jump off of stages. So I do kind of a yoga. It could be just 15 minutes, but I make sure that I stretch my body, I'd say thoroughly. And that allows me to do those crazy dances, and I still can pass for the film Groucho. And to answer your question, as I get older, there's going to be a time where I'm not going to be pull off the show the way I am right now. And I want to do it like my friend Hal Holbrook of Mark Twain Tonight. He did until he was 92. We became very close friends. And there was a middle-aged Groucho. I can play old Groucho. So the material, the show will continue to morph and evolve to accommodate my capacity physically and spiritually, clearly.
Young protege?
No, to Jay, to the protege. I like the fact that I've inspired a lot of young people over the last four decades, and I hear that all the time. I went into comedy because of you, or I went into clowning because of you. I went into the theater because of I saw your show, and I was exhilarated. I mean, if you're a kid, you don't have to know who Groucho is to like the show. I think it exhilarates young people this mature the way it exhilarated me as a boy. And so that to me is satisfying enough. We're getting further and further away from this character. And so, I'm just happy that I'm able to remind people of who he was. And that's really that's very satisfying to introduce and reintroduce.
You know, that reminds me, you had Charlie on your 9-year-old on your website that came to see your show twice. And I thought, how remarkable that someone like that, just like you're speaking to, that would come to see your show and get something out of that. So that's just remarkable.
I agree. It was affirming when you have young people see it, particularly right now. I'm playing in an area where it's a much older demographic right. than I'm used to. And you're not going to get the response when you're playing to, a senior set every show. It's not just matinees. That's hard when you're doing challenging, brash humor. I mean, an older audience wants a musical. They want Oklahoma. They don't want some guy in their face necessarily. So when you have young people going nuts who get it, that's very satisfying. I like playing to every demographic.
Frank, real quick, we have just a few moments left. Any upcoming events coming up? I know you had one locally in Chicago that's not happening, but any future plans before we wrap it up here?
No, just really more of the same. People can go online and look up my schedule. I'm constantly performing the one-man show. I do the Cirque show still. I direct plays throughout the country. So, sometimes you book out 2 years in advance, and sometimes you get a job a month before. So, but I've been lucky. I haven't stopped. We'll see. I'm not sure what 2025 has to offer, but I'd like to do some things on like a YouTube series, and I'm working on that with some colleagues of mine, at this point that intrigues me because I've done, it's like at what point you say, okay, I've done it. I'm doing it. I did the Caesar character as much as I can go. The Groucho show is currently on PBS. So anyone who wants to, you can go on PBS Passport and you can find Frank Ferrante's Groucho. So to go from a church hall performance and a student performance to PBS, it took 40 years, but I got there. So what's next? So I'm trying to think, how do I want to spend act three? I see things in terms of the theater. So this is my third act. What do I want to do with act three? I feel like I've done as much as I can do with the work I'm doing currently. So I'm looking ahead to different projects.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing your Groucho journey and everything. We're running out of time, but that's Frank Ferrante, recently at the Center for Visual Performing Arts Theater at the Center. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your origin story and your entire Groucho story with us on Art in the Air.
Thank you, Larry.
Complete pleasure. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you, Esther. Thank you for supporting the arts. Appreciate it so much. All of us do.
Hi everyone, this is recording artist David Arkenstone, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Zoo Stevenson to Art on the Air. Zoo is a self-taught painter, and her subjects are women and flowers, which provide her with the opportunity to explore color, emotion, and place. She delves into the inner world of emotion and the outer world of home. She works intuitively, allowing her to stay engaged and surprised by every moment that develops on the canvas. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Zoo. It's so nice to meet you.
Thank you. Same to you. This is such a thrill and an honor. So
yeah,
thank
for us too.
Well, we love meeting our artists and we like our audience to have a chance to get to know them. And I always like to say they'd like to hear your origin story. And I always tee that up by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Zoo.
All right. Well, it was a long and winding road. So
that's kind.
I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area and had parents who loved to travel. So my childhood was a big source of visual information as we lived overseas for 4 years and went back and forth saw many museums before they were crowded, and also just the visual art of other places. So I feel like I really developed a very rich, what I call visual history. And I think we all create one by what we live with and see and have around us in our life. It's just another form of memory. The way we have other memories, we have these visual memories. So you can enrich that with what you look at and what you have around you. And I feel fortunate that my childhood involved a lot of that. I did not, however, start as one of those kids who draws all the time and knew I was an artist. That isn't my origin story. I was always doing something creative, but in the early years, I was more attracted to dance. I took guitar for a while, but music and dance, but especially dance. I had a ballet phase, you know, like a lot of girls, but went on to just take classes in other styles, and I always loved it. And unfortunately, I didn't have the talent to actually, you know, get a career in dance. But that was my first creative true love, I would say. I guess because I'm partly, you know, an extrovert and kind of high energy. So I think it would have been hard in those days to paint where you have to be alone with yourself for a long time and pretty much, you know, quiet mental stuff. That came later. So I off and on would take a drawing class or a painting class and always loved it. But somehow I hadn't gotten the memo that it was actually really difficult. If it wasn't really great right away, I thought, oh, I guess I don't have any talent, you know, in quotes. So I would stop and just, you know, look at other people's beautiful paintings. But looking back, I did realize that almost all my friends were creative people. So I was obviously, you know, a part of who I was, but I just didn't think of it in terms of work or full-time focus. I went to college in Oregon and got a degree in nutrition, which was helpful for my own life. But I have to say, in those days, the topic wasn't the most interesting job-wise. So I instead just did other things, teaching and retail and, you know, something to pay the bills. But I found painting much later when I had time, and I also ended up, we moved back to Portland about 11, 12 years ago, and miraculously, I found teachers in my neighborhood who were just fantastic. I guess it's that thing when the student is ready, the teachers appear, I think I've heard.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah. So finally had the time and the focus and the space. And I have to give my husband huge credit. He's incredibly supportive and interested in it and helpful. And like all people, having a mentor, I would call him one because he's my support mentor. But, you know, having that person who really is cheering you on has been huge. And another reason why I finally had this time to explore painting.
So Sue, from that first, because you said you tried painting, and then when you went back to it, had your, and I'm just going to, for lack of a better word, had your style changed and had your subject matter changed? Or, because I'm just so wondering, because you were very critical of your work then, but what was the response in school or from your friends as to what you were doing?
Most of the time I did it after college, just finding a class here and there. And I think part of the problem was no one really did, you know, show much interest in it in that way at the time. It was just sort of a thing, hobby I did or whatever. But I would say that a real key for me was one of the teachers here in Portland. In the beginning, I had taken classes in oil painting, and I love it. I think it's the most beautiful material you can possibly use, but it really demands a very careful step-by-step process, sort of, because of the drying factor and the blending, you know. And then, you know, which I found difficult, but I took a class from a teacher who worked in acrylic, and he really set me free because he had a big studio room, like a warehouse, and he said, just put your canvas on the wall and just start taking the paint and just smear it, you know, just mix it. Just, and all of a sudden, painting was just so interesting to me and so doable because I could be spontaneous.
Yeah, more vibrant.
Yeah, I mean, like if something, I didn't like something, you wait 2 minutes, you can just cover it up and move on. And so it opened up the whole way of painting that is what I call more intuitive, where you don't start with a plan that you then execute carefully step by step. And I think that was the key for me to really connect to it, is that I love the results of a beautiful oil painting step by step, careful, but my personality is suited better to spontaneity, surprise, and the ability to change. Like I would do charcoal drawing before I do pen and ink because you can change and, you know, erase charcoal, but you can't really do it that easily with ink. So
no.
It was a discovery that my nature needs to be able to change things not necessarily know where I'm going with it. I really like that. So I would say that class is what changed everything for me, was that I found a way to paint that excited me and suited my personality.
You've got this sort of this color thing going, which, you know, that is very freeing to just get absorbed in the color. And so I'm very curious as to when you started to focus in on women and flowers in particular.
Well, that's a good question. I had started with flowers because I have a garden, so I do love them, and they are color, so that worked. Yeah. But I was working with an artist, kind of a mentor situation, and she looked at the photos of my work, the first class, or, you know, we did it over Zoom, and she said, oh, I had a few drawings of people just, you know, playing around. And so she said, I would like you to get 10 big pieces of paper and do 10 women in charcoal. And I looked at her, so I said, what? I'm a still life painter, you know, or whatever. And she goes, nope, I think you should do this. And I thought, well, she's the teacher and that's why I'm here. So I did it and I ended up loving it because I love faces. We're all trained to look at them and know them so well. But I have to credit her with taking me off in a new direction. I don't know why she said to do that, because I wasn't, you know, the volume of my work was still lifes of flowers with, you know, whatever, vases. And that's how things happen, right? One person does one thing and you go left instead of right. It's just fascinating to look back at that and see that really did change my trajectory without me realizing it.
Now, looking at women that I see in your paintings, do you work from a model or something like that? I noticed like one of the blonde woman appears similar in the pieces and everything. So I just wonder if you have either a real person or just your imagined person there as a model.
Most of it, I'd say 90% is from my imagination. Every once in a while, I'll look at a photograph if I need like body proportions. They're the trickiest. Or if I find a really unusual face, you know, that I just think, oh, I love that expression. You know, I might use it to begin the painting or at least to, you know, have a general idea. But 90% of them are out of my imagination. And they appear, I mean, there might be 10 layers while the face is worked out and changed until I get the right expression or the right feeling that I suddenly say, oh, here she is. And sometimes it takes a while for that to happen, a lot of redos. But yeah, they don't come from a person. I think if I tried to do a real person, I'd be so concerned about, you know, offending them if they didn't think it looked like that. And I definitely would need a lot more, you know, classes on reality and faces, which would be great to take anyway. But
I don't know. They just have like these women, they just have such this beautiful, ageless sort of medieval look, but contemporary medieval sort of.
I love that.
Continence.
That's the best compliment you could ever give, because I love medieval work because it's so flat and odd. It's this alternate universe, but it's so beautiful, especially when they
have all beautiful and lush, you know, and you capture those, like I can see the velvets and I can feel the fabric, and yet it has this beautiful paper doll sort of quality to it, or cutout paper. It's just, it's such a lush combination.
That's what I was going to say, that has that primitive look, but also the expressions on the face just draw you in. You're wondering what that person, and not all of them, but they all seem to at least be, you know, make engaging with the viewer. You know, you look at that, and it's not all of them. I know some of them have their eyes slightly off, but there's such an interesting primitive style to it. And like Esther says, yeah, you can see some of the detail in the fabric and everything like that.
The rich palette.
Palette, yes.
Beautiful.
Well, thanks, you guys. You get it. And that just makes my day because everyone has, you know, their own taste in art, and you can't please everybody. But I think that for me, the most important thing is they have some kind of emotion that you can tell they're having thoughts about something.
Yeah, they're very contemplative.
Yeah, that's, I try to paint until their personality comes through.
I feel like I would be like, as I viewed it, I was so comfortable being with them, you know, and they just had so much to say, you know, depending on which way I looked at it. And I often, you know, I could almost see you going to the farmer's market or your garden and being inspired by a particular flower that leads to. So do you start with the figure? Do you start with the flowers? What's your studio practice like?
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM on WVLP 103.1 FM.
Well, usually I just start putting some paint down, and color, you know, is really important to me. I play with that. I'm just starting to explore limited palette. I'm so excited because you get the most beautiful shades of neutrals, and then they all go together. Oh, I'm so excited about this new limited palette thing. But in general, I look after I put some paint down, I look and I just start seeing what I see, like, oh, that looks like the dress, or maybe this part could be the bouquet. And then I decide, okay, it's a woman with flowers, or, oh, it's just going to be flowers by itself. And then I will start going in, and with charcoal, I'll draw the outline of the person, you know, the basic position of their body or whatever they're going to be doing. And then from there, it's just layer and layer of working until I like it. Sometimes the figure might have 5-6 different dresses.
Yes.
Until I find one that I think, like, that's what she would wear.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
Well, studio practice, then, what time, like, do you have a time of day that you work, a specific time, or is it just by inspiration? For example, okay, I'm going to go in the studio and do this many hours every day. Sometimes writers have a discipline like that. Or is it just like, okay, I feel inspired today, I'm in there painting. What's your practice like?
You know, it's kind of a combo of both. I try to get into the studio at least 4 days a week. So that's sort of the structure part. But then I do have some flexibility about how I fit it into the week, because I also have my garden and a house and a dog and my husband. So I have to work it around things. But in general, I do 3 to 5 hours when I get really into the space. And just some days, like you probably know, it just flows. And other times, it's like, oh, gosh.
For me, it flows into 16 hours, but...
Yes. I would say that my main, you know, structure thing is just really looking at my calendar and making sure it's at least 4 days a week. It's, you know, for half a day, even whatever, just that it's regular. And then it does help to have a goal. If I have like a gallery show, that gets me a little bit more organized or more focused on time. But I need to get up in the morning and you know, do some things like work out or some things before I come down, because otherwise, you know, I'm standing and it's sort of sedentary. So I won't feel very good at the end of the day if I haven't moved some.
Right.
So I try to get all that kind of self-care stuff out of the way first and then head down. And I find certain podcasts now, if I just start them, they have this certain music and then it's like, oh, we're painting.
That's good.
A lot of podcasts. So,
or you could paint while listening to Art on the Air. That's another way.
Yeah, you're my new one. So yes. And I'm thrilled because there's so many I haven't heard. So thanks.
So I have a question about your childhood again. You had mentioned about living overseas. Where did you live, and what do you remember the museums you went to? And
sure. We were in Jordan for 1 year when I was in third grade. And then we went to Iran for 4 years when I was 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th grades. So junior high and high school. Yeah, those years. But this was a long time ago before, you know, those countries were sort of unvisitable. I feel very fortunate. You know, we we saw all the Iranian, you know, history. We made it to Afghanistan before that went haywire. We went to India, Nepal.
What rich visuals. Whew.
Very, very interesting countries and the history and the architecture and the art. And then every year we'd go back and forth through Europe on the way home, you know, because you'd get a trip home. And my parents had met in Europe, so, you know, they loved it. And we went to all the museums, the Louvre, all the big ones, which I just revisited. And man, the crowds, what a difference. I was like, I can't see the art.
Oh, no.
You know, also living in Washington, D.C., we had lovely museums there as well. So it was a great backdrop to, like I said, developing a taste for art. But I would say that there was an exhibit in Paris I saw in the 80s, maybe, of a Manet. And that is when it truly all came together for me, because as beautiful as the religious art was, and the mythic stories and all that, they didn't really speak to my heart personally. But Manet brought it into not the modern world, not my modern world, but he was showing people in cafes or just normal life rather than historic moments and, you know, myths and stuff. And that's when I saw his early late flower paintings, and I thought, oh my God, I want to paint. Those are so beautiful. So I would credit him with the real trigger to finally getting that, you know, painting and creating something so beautiful would be really exciting.
Yeah, well, you do create beautiful paintings.
Oh, thank you.
Well, is there some kind of art that you have not done yet that you'd like to explore? Like, you kind of mastered your thing, and you talked a little bit about the limited palette, but is there something like, okay, I want to do something, whatever that is, some other completely
ceramics.
Different. Ceramics. Or something completely different subject-wise.
Yeah, that's a great question. I do know a lot of painters cross over and do ceramics, so that right. would be interesting to do and find out why. And plus, I love ceramics. I could have my house filled with them. But I'd have to say painting-wise, I just took an excellent class from an artist, Zoe Cohen, who lives in Eugene, Oregon, and it was abstract. She works in abstract art, beautiful, poetic abstracts with color and so that class was very interesting and very enjoyable. So that would probably be my next, you know, if I was going to say I would like to try something new, it would be a more abstract presentation to see how much emotion you can really get into them. Because some of those paintings are filled with it. And I'm not sure how they do it. Nothing real or, you know, no things to respond to. So that's kind of fascinating.
Yeah, that would be interesting to explore.
And did you ever think about moving? You touched on this briefly, but maybe going into a much more naturalistic portraiture or a subject like complete outdoor scenics or something of that nature.
You know, landscapes haven't drawn me yet. I like looking at other people's, but it's not something that I'm drawn to. But I have thought about maybe having more than one figure in my paintings eventually, or this next series, I want to have them at least sort of maybe in a room or, you know, something else going on, add some still life objects like, you know, fruits and vegetables or tea items or something, you know, that's probably my next branch off exploration. Cause you know, you really can't do it all. It turns out.
The two paintings that you did that were primarily black, was that paint or was that charcoal? I mean, it looked like paint to me rather than charcoal. They were beautiful.
One was definitely paint, the woman in the black dress. Well,
with the big sleeves or right. the...
Well, that was charcoal. Yes, that one was charcoal. And then I do have another one that I've done that was paint, black and white paint.
Yeah, they both look like they were based on someone. Like the rest of them just seemed... You know, it could be this, you know, like you described the way you do it. But for some reason, that one with the large sleeve seemed like it was someone.
You are absolutely right. You are very good at reading a painting or a drawing, because that was Pina Bausch, the German dance woman who did beautiful choreography. She's a choreographer. I think she's passed away now. But that was her when she was younger in that incredible dress, and she had the kind of face I find really interesting. So
yeah, very classic.
That was based on a real person, which is unusual, but Pina Bausch. Yep.
Yeah, it's a beautiful painting.
Thank you.
Well, you have about a minute and a half left. We want to give you an opportunity to tell us about how people can find you online. Also, if you do commissions, and finally, like if you have any upcoming exhibits like November, December of this year or beyond, just tell us about all those things.
Okay, thank you. My website is my name, luckily. It's simple. Zue Stevenson, spelled with a V, Stevenson. Instagram is Zue Paintings with an S, Zue Paintings. And I am represented by Museo Gallery up in Langley, Washington, but I just had my exhibit in September, so I'm not sure yet when the next one is. But their website is museo, M-U-S-E-O, .cc, not .com for some reason.
Yeah, they can't get the .com. There's a lot of places you can't get the .com anymore. You're fortunate in like that way. So
I guess it's run out.
It has. They have a lot more suffixes now available, or what they call the upper level domains. So, well, Zue, this has been a wonderful experience exploring your art, having you on the show and explain, the wonderful things that you have in your art. That's Zue Stevenson. You can find her at ZueStevensonwithav.com. We'll have a link on our website. And you can also find her elsewhere at the Musso, that's MUSCO.CC Gallery. Zue, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your art journey.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
Me too. Very appreciated.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or send us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.